From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from the Ring of Fire Studios in Pensacola, Florida. Always great to be here. Once again, my great thanks for Mike Papantonio for warmly welcoming us to his facility, and to Scott Milliken, who does just about everything around here. He is so helpful to us and generously agrees to handle the technical aspects of this week's show. I'm so grateful for both of them. Happy Thanksgiving to you. I hope you've been able to step away from the pressures of the day to take some time with friends and family to savor what life in this great country has to offer, and to feel appreciation for the fact that in so many ways we are among the most fortunate people on this earth. I also want to say a special thank you to each and every State of Belief supporter. Your financial contributions are essential to keeping this show on the air. And while I know that appeals for charitable donations in connection with the upcoming Giving Tuesday are already abundant, I do sincerely hope you will consider State of Belief Radio and Interfaith Alliance as worthy of your support. We're seeing an unprecedented need for the kind of constitution-based, nonpartisan work that the Interfaith Alliance does every single day, as assaults from both political and religious figures threaten the pluralistic coexistence that is the bedrock of our nation. And the voices that State of Belief Radio is able to amplify would all too often go unheard were we not on the air every week across the country. We're counting on you. We need your support. Please go to stateofbelief.com and interfaithalliance.org for more information. That's stateofbelief.com and interfaithalliance.org. You know, I have to reflect today some myself. I am personally grateful for the work that I've been privileged to do and to host this program, as well as to do what I did in my former role as president of Interfaith Alliance. During my 16 years in that position, I had a front row seat for what I consider to be the most important struggles for liberty and American values of our times. And what I've been able to speak to you directly on this program about that work for almost 10 years now, there have been other initiatives for celebrating the heroes of this movement that have happened both on and off the air. On a Thanksgiving weekend, I have to say how grateful I am for you and for the opportunity to visit with you and for the opportunity to be at Interfaith Alliance. It has been an experience that is both satisfying in terms of my patriotism and in terms of my religion. In 1998, Interfaith Alliance unveiled the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award. As a matter of fact, my first day on the job with Interfaith Alliance was to go to the Walter Cronkite meeting in which he agreed to become the spokesperson for the organization. What a way to begin. Over the years, the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award, that honor has been bestowed on just a very few individuals who we saw as invaluable in the struggles for protecting constitutional principles and religious freedom. And today, I want to highlight several of those awardees as a way to celebrate both the past work and the ongoing challenges that you hear about every week on State of Belief Radio. Walter Cronkite would never do a political endorsement. He would never do a partisan thing while he was doing the evening news. After he retired, he ran into Terry Anderson. Do you remember Terry Anderson, the journalist that was held hostage in Lebanon by Hezbollah for two whole years? And Terry Anderson told Walter about this organization that was trying to get off the ground and was wanting to do the kinds of things that would challenge Americans and let Americans know, by the way, that it was not just all Christians in this land. You remember Pat Robertson was having his day then. Congress was passing more religious legislation, and Walter paid attention to that. Not long after that, he saw Joan Brown Campbell, who was the head of the National Council of Churches of Christ in the United States, and she told him about Interfaith Alliance. He said he was interested in that and that he would, for the first time, write a letter of endorsement for an organization. I didn't know how unique it was for him to endorse the organization, and so we gave him the first Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award and said that we were naming that award after him, and subsequently the award would be presented in his name. One of the first things that I wanted to do after that event was to put together a committee that would consider a lot of nominees for the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award, and then I was able to bring together an exciting group of people. In fact, when I met with them the first time on the phone, I thought this may be the highest profile people I will ever gather and lead in a conversation about picking an awardee. President Gerald Ford was the chair of that committee. With him were Joan Brown Campbell. Cokie Roberts was on the committee. She did not get to come to the meeting. Congressman John Lewis, Bill Moyers, Andy Young. If you don't think I was nervous that day, then you don't know me. That's the committee that we brought together. President Ford presided. He had read every nominee's resume, and he began by saying, I want the nominee to be people we don't know. And so he suggested two people whose names most people would not know. Donna Redwing, who at that time was working with HRC and had been doing tremendous work on GLBT issues. And he mentioned a name I did not know, a man named Chris Doss, who was in Alabama at the time and had done a lot of work in promoting education without indoctrination, keeping the public schools what they are, and seeing to it that religion was not in the classroom in a partisan or sectarian way. Now, Walter Cronkite was far more committed to Interfaith Alliance than I ever thought he would be. We had a conversation. We made a deal about how much time we would try to get from him, and it would always be for some important reason or we wouldn't bother him. It was incredibly, I can't even stress how incredibly important it was for Walter Cronkite to be endorsing Interfaith Alliance. We wanted to be sure that we are nonpartisan. We wanted to be sure that all religions are involved and people of no religion at all. Walter Cronkite was known then and is still known today as the most trusted man in America. Launching an Interfaith Alliance organization that would stand at the intersection of religion and politics, it was terribly important that the most trusted man in America said, I trust these people and I support them. I want you to hear his voice. Listen to Walter's words. They were important then. They may be more important than ever today.
Walter, I'll never forget some words that you spoke to me right after I came to this position of leadership, the Interfaith Alliance. In fact, it was at the first announcement of the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award. You took me aside and you said, what is at stake in the success of the mission of this organization is nothing less than the vitality and continuation of democracy itself. Those words have come to my mind, if not daily, certainly regularly, and they mean a lot to me in terms of encouragement. I wonder, do you have a personal word for someone trying to give leadership to this organization?
I probably couldn't say it any better myself. No, Walton, I do believe that in order to hold our faith, and by holding our faith, we are, our deed are the foundation of democracy, each of our faiths, we are supporting the democracy in a fashion that can't be done in any other way. It is the thread of life through which the lifeblood of democracy pumps.
We are also pleased every year to present the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award.
Very proud of that.
Well, I was going to ask you what the establishment of that award meant to you.
Well, it meant a lot by being recognized by you people who are those who keep the Interfaith Alliance going. That was a major tribute, I thought, that I could accept with humility, with as much humility as a television news person can muster, of course. But and I thought it was a wonderful place to recognize the courage that is required at times to stand up and speak one's mind, particularly in a closed community, of which we have too many in this country. And most of our winners of that award have represented that group who endanger their actual livelihood, endanger their leadership roles by coming out and taking a position which seems to be counter to the mass at the moment. I admire political courage, I admire personal courage, and I admire religious courage. And those people who have been honored by the Walter Cronkite Award have, for the most part, displayed that.
We're observing the Thanksgiving Day holiday with a look back at the history of Interfaith Alliance's Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards, a celebration of leaders in the essential work for interreligious cooperation and for democracy itself. The excitement over the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award caused us to make this an annual event. We'd always wanted to do that. We wondered whether or not that would fly, and it did. The reason we did that was because, you know, from where you are, you're not always surrounded by people who are cheering a progressive agenda and trying to protect religious freedom. So we had people from all over the nation who wanted to come to that event because they wanted to have time associating, one, with Walter Cronkite, who wouldn't, but two, to be with like-minded individuals, to be in a room that is full of people who think like you do and want the kind of freedom, both religious and otherwise, in America that everyone should want. When I look back over the names of the people who receive this award and think about the activism that they represent, both nationally and internationally, I feel very good. I think of Keith Jennings, a civil rights leader that worked tirelessly on voting rights issues all across our country. And he did that with great respect for democracy and what democracy means. I also think of people like Dr. James Miller, who was an interfaith activist up in the Northeast and did a powerful amount of work of reconciliation in communities there. I think of Jawad Khaki, who worked on the West Coast and took time from his job to do volunteer work in helping people of different religions and of different ethnicities to come together and be one as American people making contributions to their country. I remember that we gave the award one year to Frosty Troy. Frosty Troy had an independent newspaper in Oklahoma, and he was an avid activist for public schools. He got his award the same evening that Peter Jennings, then the anchor of ABC News, got his. And when Peter Jennings made some comments at our table, not before the whole group, but at our table about funding for education and his support for vouchers, Frosty Troy erupted. And over our dinner, before the speeches, before the crowd, Frosty gave Peter Jennings a lesson on why we so badly need public schools and what our founders thought they could bring to the strength of our nation. I also think of Rabbi Irwin Kula as an activist. He has been an activist not just for the Jewish community, but for all communities. He knows what religious freedom is all about, and I think we ought to hear a clip from him right now.
One little light, you know, winning out. And therefore, it turns out that there's a miracle story of when Judah Maccabee walks into the temple that had been desecrated in Jerusalem. He finds one cruse of oil. That cruse of oil is enough to last one day. He chooses to light the candelabrum in the temple, the menorah, and oil lasts 8 days. And therefore, we celebrate for 8 days. But the story, I mean, what it's really about is a sense that no matter how dark it gets, there is a possibility of light, however small the spark is, and however hopeless it seems, there is always, as long as one is taking a breath, there is always some hope. It's a version of what's the chance of a baby in a barn, in a manger, actually, you know, transforming a world.
What's the word for today? I always need to ask you that, because you always have one. What is the message, what is the word for this Hanukkah season?
I think it's, look, it's always love and hope. I mean, those are always the words. But right now, the most important thing we can do is not protest out of anger, but out of righteous indignation. And the difference between anger and righteous indignation is so profound. If we really believe we're all in this together, including the people with whom we deeply disagree, including the people who have, for a variety of reasons, very distorted ways of behaving in the world, but if we really believe we're all in this together, we're going to have to begin to understand the partial truths. And maybe that's what it is, partial truths. The partial truths, I didn't say 50-50 truths, but the partial truths of the people with whom we disagree. Now, I'm not talking about ISIS. Maybe that's going a little too far. But when you look around this country and the many, many good people in this country, the predominance of goodness in this country, yes, there are real systemic problems, because all people build things and then have systemic problems about what they build because we're imperfect. But if we can just begin to understand, to listen, maybe listen, listen real, maybe listen's the word. We need to listen. The biggest thing is that voices are not being heard. And when voices are not being heard, they do everything from blow up things to go into despair. We have to listen. And those with more privilege have to listen. It's the Spider-Man rule. Whoever has more power simply has more responsibility.
Well, that's Rabbi Irwin Kula, still going strong as president of CLOUD, the Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership in New York City. Interfaith Alliance honored him with the award in 2008. But that same year, we saluted a leading Muslim voice in interreligious activism, Asra Nomani, an outspoken Muslim feminist, activist, and journalist. Her work was national, but some of the best work she did was in her home community, where she was the first woman ever to go into a mosque in that community on the men's side and claim her place as just a Muslim, not a Muslim woman, not a Muslim man, but a Muslim who wanted to worship with all. She has done tremendous work. I want you to hear her.
Sadly, the Muslim world in the 21st century is just in the dark ages when it comes to the status of women. And I think that we are actually practicing an Islam that is in contradiction to the early teachings in the 7th century. For example, in the 7th century, the Prophet Muhammad built a mosque in the city of Medina, and women participated freely. We had a Florence Nightingale who had a corner of the mosque, and she would help the wounded. We had women who would challenge the Prophet in, you know, edicts that he would talk about. And now in the 21st century, in mosques in America, it said in a survey that 2 out of 3 mosques require that a woman be behind a curtain, a wall. Some cases it's even as lame as a shower curtain, like they throw that up. Sometimes it's a one-way mirror. And I think a natural evolution is going to inevitably happen in the Muslim world. It just hasn't fully been realized yet.
But, you know, Asra, you've made what I think is a profoundly important point, and that is that the basis of your leadership in feminism is not coming from an effort to modernize Islam. It's coming from an effort to recover the essential integrity of Islam at its inception.
Yeah, and I see, you know, that our Christian and Jewish brothers and sisters are doing the same. I mean, because at the end of the day, you know, we're all struggling as individuals and as society with these drives, you know, of greed, consumerism, loathing, hatred, all of these things that take us away from faith. I think the best of faith. And as individuals, we face these challenges, and then as societies, we face them. And so now in our Muslim world, what you will hear from the critics of women and men also who are trying to reclaim these early teachings is that we are changing the religion and that we're trying to create, for example, when we're in America, an American brand of Islam. But basically, what we're doing is challenging their interpretation.
Few secular issues have been as relentlessly subjected to condemnation via supposedly religious rhetoric as have LGBT rights in this country. Conservative Christian sensibilities have been the primary and often only consideration in delaying or denying full inclusion of this minority in our secular society. So it should come as no surprise that interfaith LGBT leaders have figured prominently at the Cronkite Awards over the years. But among them is 2008 awardee Judy Shepherd, mother of Matthew Shepherd and founder of the Matthew Shepherd Foundation. And in 2012, I was so proud to present the President's Award to lifelong activist Mitchell Gold. He had this to say on State of Belief that year. I don't think I'll ever forget his comments.
He who saves a single life, it is as though they have saved the entire world. And sometimes when I talk to a parent or a young 13-year-old that's on the verge of committing suicide, and I help that 13-year-old or 15-year-old or 45-year-old or parents cope with it better and come out of it feeling that the burden of bigotry has been lifted from their shoulders and that they're far better people. I mean, these are the things that inspire me to go on, and I would encourage everybody. You only have to save one life to really have a whole new meaning to your own life.
Yeah.
I want people to stop being complicit with the harm to LGBT people. Hmm. I want them, if they're standing at the water cooler, to just say, stop, enough is enough. I want them, if they hear their clergy person saying something, to go to them and say, stop, enough is enough. And because of that, there was a minister in the audience of a black church, Anthony Spearman, and he came to see me afterwards and he said, you know, he said, I'm that person you were talking about. I've been complicit. I don't dislike gay people at all, but I've never really stepped out to help. And T. Anthony, has gone on to become one of the greatest advocates in the state of North Carolina. He has changed so many people's lives. He was very instrumental in getting the president of the NAACP in the state of North Carolina to come out against the anti-gay marriage amendment. This has been remarkable work, and it was largely simply because I told people to stop being complicit. And that's what I would say to everybody who hears this and pass it on, that the truth is that if you're not helping people get out of harm's way, then you're being complicit with them being in harm's way.
Mitchell Gold continues to be a leading voice defending those oppressed by homophobia in the guise of religion, as founder of the nonprofit Faith in America, as a generous supporter of many charitable causes, and most recently as an active partner in the Interfaith Alliance We Serve Everyone Only anti-discrimination campaign.
Hi, this is Rabbi Jack Moline, Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance. Thanks for giving me a couple of minutes to speak with you about State of Belief Radio. You know, if you're like me, you welcome the voice of my friend, Reverend C. Welton Gaddy, when he comes into your home, into your car, onto your computer, to talk about the intersection between religion and government, the intersection between church and state in this country. We're very proud of State of Belief Radio, and Interfaith Alliance would like to keep this program coming to you as it has for the past 10 years and thriving in the process. So we'd like to ask you to be our partners in that effort. To visit stateofbelief.com or interfaithalliance.org and make a contribution to support your voice in Washington, D.C., in state capitals across this country, and wherever you find a radio, a smartphone, a tablet, or a computer playing this podcast. A gift of $25, $50, or $100 would help us keep State of Belief Radio presenting the kinds of programs you hear nowhere else. You know, this Tuesday is Giving Tuesday, an extraordinary opportunity to extend the values we just celebrated on Thanksgiving and to promote the genuine values of the holiday season ahead. And among those values are highlighting the wisdom of extraordinary guests that Welton has had on State of Belief Radio. Many of them, as you heard today, winners of the Walter Cronkite Award from Interfaith Alliance, people who have been true champions of genuine religious freedom and true religious liberty, guaranteeing the rights and privileges of the First Amendment to all members of this great nation. So please visit stateofbelief.com or interfaithalliance.org and make a gift of $25, $50, or $100 to keep State of Belief Radio broadcasting. And I thank you very much.
Today we're celebrating Thanksgiving with a sampling of some of the leaders who have been honored over the years with the Interfaith Alliance Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award, which dates back to 1998. Celebrity is a platform for doing good in this country. And perhaps because not all celebrities take advantage of that opportunity, those who do are especially deserving of recognition. Over the years, George Clooney, Peter Jennings, Larry King, Jim Lehrer, Bill and Judith Moyers were among our honorees. And yes, many of them are journalists. People who, like Walter Cronkite, had to face the special challenge of navigating the fine line between objectivity and abdicating responsibility. Now, two more journalists who received the award devoted their extraordinary talents to work that did much to advance the cause of faith and freedom for all. In 2007, Interfaith Alliance honored Sally Quinn and John Meacham. Together, they helped bring responsible discussion of religion to prominence in our nation's capital, launching the Washington Post's On Faith section. I was a part of that initiative, and it was terrifically helpful to all kind of people who were interested in religion. I have to tell you that John Meacham did one of the best interviews that I ever remember doing. It was in connection with his book, American Gospel, and as you know, John has gone on to write other very, very popular pieces that teach us more about our nation and the kinds of values that make it strong.
I think the idea that we were founded as a Christian nation is the most persistent myth, because I think many people on the religious right believe that we were founded as a Christian nation, that we have fallen from those pure origins, and that the point of political action is to get back to that Edenic state. If we could recover the spirit and sense of the Christian founding of the country, then would our moral life be more coherent? Things would be well. It's an appealing myth, and like many myths, it's full of holes. Historically, there is quite the opposite of there being evidence for this being a Christian nation. There's evidence to the contrary. George Washington, in 1790, in his first 4 years president, wrote a letter to the Hebrew congregation at Newport, Rhode Island, saying that the government of the United States shall give to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance. And then, borrowing an image from Micah, he said, "Every man should sit under his vine and fig tree, and none shall make him afraid." We passed a treaty in 1797 with the Muslim nation of Tripoli, in which we said that the government of the United States is in no sense founded on the Christian religion. The only mention of religion in the Constitution is to ban test oaths, so that your civil rights were not part of any religious profession of belief. Theologically, as you know, you can't have a Christian nation. Just using the Christian scriptures, Jesus said to Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were of this world, then would my servants fight." And so I think that is the Christian nation myth is the most persistent. I think if we can talk to people who believe that on both historical and theological grounds and convince them that it's not the case, then I think to some extent the volume could come down a bit.
You conclude in your book that preserving American freedom is the most demanding of tasks, requires unrelenting work and a resilient spirit. If you're doing that work, what are the top two or three items on your agenda?
Religious liberty is often called our first liberties, the first liberty in the First Amendment. And it's not just about what you do on Sunday morning, or it's not about somebody frog marching you down to a certain church. It's about liberty of thought. It's about how you think. It's about democracy. It's about how we can live and work together without coercion. And so I think the first thing to do is to ensure religious liberty, ensure freedom of conscience, make sure that church and state stay separate, but to respect that religion and politics can't be separated. And so, you know, if you're watching Meet the Press, if you're watching C-SPAN, if you're listening and you're following a debate and a person says, well, we have to do X for a religious reason, don't go crazy. Don't pound the person. Don't think, oh, my God, that's some crazy Christer. It may be. That person may be all those things. But they have a right to make this case, and you have a right to make the opposite case on whatever grounds you want. And the point of America, the point of the Republican system, lowercase r, as laid out in Federalist 10, is that all of us will go into the arena, we will let the contending forces bump up against each other, and through a system of checks and balances, we'll reach some temporary solution to something that'll get us through one storm until the next storm comes. Democracy is a completely unfinished work.
In 2010, when issues of faith and freedom were far from the mainstream media's front burner, we honored television host Rachel Maddow for her outstanding work despite the inherent risks of being both branded anti-religious by the right and alienating her progressive MSNBC audience, all too frequently stereotyped as disinterested in matters of faith. I have to tell you, it was a chore to get Rachel to do this, because Rachel does not do her work for reward. She does it because she's carrying out what she thinks is her responsibility in the nation, and she does it well. But finally, I said, "Rachel, I think you have a responsibility to take this award." And after 2 years, she said, "Okay, I will do it."
I feel like we are a very religious country. And regardless of what anyone's individual personal religious beliefs are, you can't understand America or American politics without understanding religion and how it drives us in so many different ways, and how much of our constitutional heritage and what is unique and important about the way the founding fathers set this country up for us and the reason we're still around this many centuries later has to do with understanding of and appreciation for the importance of religion. So how can you not want to talk about it? I think that liberals in particular have a shyness around the issue that's born from the right place. It's born out of respect for the privacy of the issue. But it means that we don't fully participate, I think, in the national discussion about religion in a way that we really ought to be.
I remember your first show on MSNBC, and you dealt – in a large part of that show, you dealt with the subject of church-state relations.
That's right.
Was that a risk?
You know, I remember a lot of the discussion on that first show about church and state division was with Pat Buchanan,
right?
Who is my great sparring partner and my weird ideological bookend in television. And Pat didn't seem uncomfortable, because he never seems uncomfortable because he's such a confident debater. But he seemed surprised that I was doing that. He was sort of starting to caution me. You ought to stay away from this religion stuff. It's going to look bad. You attacking people on the basis of their religion. And I was saying, no, that's not what I'm doing. But I am willing to talk about religion because I believe in the division of church and state, and because it's been foisted on us. I mean, that was immediately following that test case Sunday where the right wing legal group put up all those pastors toward making explicit endorsements from the pulpit. And I don't feel shy about the issue. I don't believe that liberals should feel shy about the issue. And I don't feel like talking about religion is insulting to religious people. But Pat was shocked about it, which I thought was kind of great.
Rachel continues to do great work. She's doing just exactly what she needs to be doing. As we celebrate Thanksgiving with a look back at the honorees of Interfaith Alliance's Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards, a number of political leaders appear on the list. So do representatives of a diverse number of faith traditions, as well as of no religion at all. But perhaps some of the most moving moments, at least for me personally, came in handing that delicate, curved crystal statue to individuals who had come to be friends, my dearest friends, due to years and decades of working together to advance the cause of religious liberty for all in this country, those whose focus was less on their own faith traditions and more on the traditions most vulnerable to abuse and oppression. And that most certainly includes American atheists and humanists. I'll never forget the year that Reverend Dr. Joan Brown Campbell received our award. It was 2010, and Joan ordained at age 50, a critical participant in the founding of Interfaith Alliance, former General Secretary of the National Council of Churches, USA, former Director of the U.S. Office of the World Council of Churches, was honored by Archbishop Desmond Tutu with the words, "Her voice helped to bring an end to the evil of apartheid."
People who know my history now always hear me say that I was privileged to work with Martin Luther King. And there's just no question in my mind but what that set for me a pattern of faith. What I saw in King was a person who did, they were truly, he was an incarnational person. He did what he said he believed. And that was so helpful for me to see this. I mean, that the cross was not just for Jesus, but the suffering that is required of Christian people or of people of any faith, if they want to be serious about their fellow human beings, it doesn't come easy. And I think once I got into my mind and my heart and my soul, I suppose, this is what it's about. It's really about entering into that suffering and not in a kind of self-conscious, you know, punishing way, but in a way of joy. What I saw in King was a way of joy that said, you know, I'm engaged in the freedom of my people, and this is my Christian calling. Mm-hmm. And when people would say to him, Martin, you keep this up, and you're going to get killed, and he would sort of give a half smile and say, I suppose that's possible. And he wasn't grim about it, and he wasn't overly religious about it. It was more, that's, you know, I keep saying it from the book of Esther. It's like when Esther says, I go, and if I perish, I perish. And I keep saying to young people, somewhere in your life, sometime, something's going to happen to you, whatever it will be, and you will have to say, I go, and if I perish, I perish. Not to die, but to give your life to something that in fact costs you something. It isn't a free ride.
Yeah. Let me ask you, because I know that Walter Cronkite has something to do with everything we're talking about, what are some of your fondest memories of Walter in relation to what we're talking about?
Well, of course, Walter Cronkite was a man on a pedestal for most of us. I mean, not because he was so unapproachable, but just because he had such a solid and secure and revered reputation. And I remember that I was asked to go on a show when I was general secretary to be interviewed by Walter Cronkite. Well, believe me, it was a little bit of an awesome experience. And at that point, we were wrestling very much with the growth of the religious right, rather rapid growth of the religious right. And it had been my concern that I didn't feel the way to deal with the religious right was for Christians to start fighting each other, and that what we really needed was an interfaith group that would begin to deal with these issues of the right, because finally they were not just Christian issues. And so it was the beginning ideas that formed the Interfaith Alliance. And Walter Cronkite looked at me in the middle of the interview and he said, if you're really going to do that, then I want to be part of it. And we'll talk after the show. And I thought, whoa. That was like, wow. And what I discovered, which you know very well, was he meant it.
I want to end our look back at the history of the Interfaith Alliance Faith and Freedom Award by remembering the late Reverend Dr. Jane Holmes Dixon, the retired Episcopal Bishop of Washington, D.C. I was humbled to receive the award myself in 2012, and it was Jane who honored me in that moment only weeks before her death on Christmas Day. The year prior, Jane was the recipient of the Cronkite Award in recognition of her lifetime of work for inclusivity and the inherent dignity of every person. I don't know how to describe this woman to you, except I never knew anyone not to like her unless it was someone who was prejudiced or so severely partisan they could not be a good American. She was the best of us, the best in the religious tradition, the best in the patriotic tradition. And she went to the streets, not just to her office. She was in Congress going before congressional hearings. She was writing. She was speaking more times a week than most of us could imagine. And she was marching. Now, she marched in protest on a lot of different issues. Now, I have to tell you that her husband, Dixie, told me one time that she was the only woman he ever knew that would go get her nails done just before the protest. But she was a person of dignity and beauty and worth. She was kind of like Walter Cronkite himself. And that's about the greatest compliment I can pay to anybody. Listen, please, to Jane Holmes Dixon.
I believe, Welton, that there are more folk who are willing to be engaged in these conversations than we think. I think to sit there and think, well, they're not really willing to interact with me because we have different views on theology. I just don't think that's true. I think that people want to be engaged with one another. And I think if I would give any advice to anybody, it's to reach out a hand. People can only tell you no. But the important thing is so many more people are willing, I believe, to tell you yes. Now, I'm a blessed person. My introduction back in the late 70s was to a Jewish congregation who were open to having that conversation with me and helping me form as an Episcopal priest. Now, that's not everybody's good fortune, and I know that. But it was certainly my work in Laurel, Maryland, to work with the congregation there. In fact, I had the rabbi read the scripture, the Hebrew scripture, at my consecration in 1992. So I think that there's more goodwill out there.
Would you talk with first-year seminarians or people who are on their way to ordination, what do you tell them you think the biggest challenges of the future will be for them?
That's a really interesting question and one that's very hard to answer. Why are we not being able to tell the story, as politicians would say, our narrative? Why are we not being able to tell that with the power and the life-changing ability that it certainly has had on my life? And how are they going to be in today's world and to do that, to do it faithfully? Because one of the things I learned at the Interfaith Alliance, as well as with the other interfaith work I have done, it doesn't take away from my Christianity. It doesn't diminish it at all to be in conversation with people of other religious traditions. It makes me learn to articulate what I believe. And so that's what I would say and what I have said. How are you going to get that message out? And I think so much of it is not only telling it, but living it.
Okay, what fun it was going back through those memories and being inspired again by those people and what they brought to the table and what contributions they made to our nation, as well as how they helped Interfaith Alliance be a nonpartisan organization working with all religions and people of no religion to protect religious freedom in this nation. You know, as I listen to them, I have to think, friends, the battle is not over. They got us here. They did their work. We've still got to do some work ourselves. We're at a critical time in our nation where bigotry has far too much exposure and popularity. Religious freedom is in trouble. Organizations like Interfaith Alliance, but Interfaith Alliance especially, need help. They need financial support. They need people just like you signing up. We've got a big challenge before us right now as we tape. Please step up. Support all the time you can, with all the money you can, those who are trying to defend religious freedom with success. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. On Giving Tuesday this coming week, please consider very seriously making a special tax-deductible donation to State of Belief Radio and Interfaith Alliance. Our work has never, honestly, it has never been more important. And we rely on your generous support to keep it going in Washington, D.C. and across the nation. Of course, you don't have to wait until Tuesday. In fact, if you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this show this week that you think would be helpful to friends or acquaintances, please share it with them. It's very easy to do on Facebook, Twitter, and at stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you'll find extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Now, thanks for listening today. Happy Thanksgiving to you and to yours. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what?